For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome, everyone, to Monday Match Analysis. I'm Gil Gross. Week one of clay court season is over, and it was all about the big bangers this week. Ben Shelton wins in Houston. Matteo Berrettini wins in Marrakesh. Hubert Hurkacz wins in Estoril. And we're on to Monte Carlo. In this video, I'm not going to do a lot of deep match analysis, but I do have thoughts, things to say, points to make, mainly about Matteo Berrettini and Ben Shelton. And then we're going to get to a Monte Carlo preview. Now, it's a Sunday start. They've played four matches. The scheduling and everything, it was just tough this week because I wasn't going to be able to do the Monte Carlo preview. Unless I did it on Friday instead of the mailbag, I wasn't going to be able to do it before the event started. So it is what it is. Yes, it's a little bit cheating, but we're going to do it. We're going to go for it because I think it's better than not doing it. Certainly better than not doing it, right? Let's start with Berrettini. So whenever somebody comes back from injury and they lose, we say, oh, they need matches. Can't win without matches. Everybody needs matches. If you come back from injury, you need matches. I don't think Matteo Berrettini needs matches. First off, the last 2 years combined, he has played six total matches on clay. That means 2022, 2023. Add them up. Six. He's barely played on clay for 2 years. This was his first clay event of this year. And then you look at the history and you see what Matteo has done. Last year, he hurt his ab in Monte Carlo. He comes back. He plays the one match at Stuttgart, which I think everybody believes at this point was just to appease his sponsor, Hugo Boss, because he didn't look ready at all to play, got crushed by Lorenzo Sonego, and then pulled out of Queens. And he comes to Wimbledon. The expectations are understandably low. He hasn't won a match since Monte Carlo. And he makes the fourth round of Wimbledon, gets revenge over Sonego, beats Zverev and Dimonor. He plays mind-blowingly well at Wimbledon. Ultimately, he loses to Alcaraz. Rewind to 2022. He gets hurt at Indian Wells. He does not play Miami. He does not play any clay season. He misses all of it. He comes onto the grass, wins Stuttgart, wins Queens. Didn't get to play Wimbledon because he got COVID. It was that year. So the man hadn't played in months. Like, I didn't actually look at it, but what? That's like three months and maybe change? Maybe just 3 months flat? And he comes back, wins two titles. So this here in Marrakesh, and yeah, it's not necessarily a gauntlet. He beat Alexander Shevchenko, Jaume Munar, Lorenzo Sonego, Mariano Navone, and Roberto Carballes Baena. And Marrakesh, traditionally, if you look at it, it's, I'll say this, top five easiest 250s to win every year. And I'm just going by strength of field in terms of rankings. And then if you look at the past champions, it's been an opportunity for a lot of players to make runs. Like, you know, Alexander Muller was in the final last year, just as an example. And then, you know, Roberto Carballes Baena, he was in the final again this year. He won it last year. But the point is, Berrettini has shown time and time again a strong ability to just come back onto tour after injury layoffs, which unfortunately he's had to do too often, and he's good right away. Obviously, I watched every match that he played in Phoenix. I watched the Andy Murray match in Miami. I have watched an insane amount of Matteo. I even called a lot of his matches last week. And I thought he was going to win this title, and it didn't surprise me he was going to win this title because from the very start, even in Phoenix, I thought, look, the guy's not that far away. He's just not. He's a little off. He doesn't look like a top 10 player, but at no point did he look very far away from the Matteo Berrettini that we know very well. Just small details with footwork, consistency, losses in focus. Obviously, the heat got to him in Miami. Maybe that's a product of certain things that I don't know, maybe he wasn't used to that. Maybe if he had been on the circuit playing week in and week out for longer, he would have handled the humidity a little bit better against Andy Murray. That's ultimately what beat him. But for the most part, he just looks like Berrettini. So I don't think this is going to take very long for him at all to break back into, you know, the top 50 and then the top 30 and then the top 20. I also want to talk about Berrettini's career because there is something that has happened with him that at face value might be a little strange to some people. And it's the fact that he's won 4 career titles on clay and now 4 career titles on grass. And clay and grass being on polar opposites of speed, I did get a question in the mailbag last week. What's up with that? And I think, you know, now that Berrettini has won his 4th career clay title, I do want to take this time to explain that. So surface preferences come down to weakness minimization and strength amplification. So whatever your strengths and weaknesses are as a player, it's about, does this surface complement those strengths and weaknesses? And in what ways does that happen? The thing is with Berrettini, grass and clay both work for different reasons when it comes to weakness minimization and strength amplification. So let's start with grass. It's pretty obvious, right? The serve strength of Berrettini is amplified. But now let's look at his weakness. It's the backhand. But he does have a good slice. Now, if you don't drive your backhand well and you only slice, that is a limitation that opponents are able to take advantage of. But on grass, the slice is at its most effective. That's weakness minimization. His backhand goes from a weakness to not so much a weakness because the slice is so good. And I think that's pretty easy to get. But I think on clay, Berrettini's actually underrated because it's not as obvious how the surface helps him. But here's the answer, at least to me. His forehand is amplified due to the extra time he gets and the liveliness of the bounce. So it bounces up higher for him. He's good with that. And the heavy RPM he gets on the forehand, he gets to the ball maintains a lot of speed off the court surface because it's not like he's a flat hitter, right? This isn't a guy like who has a huge forehand like Del Potro and it's flat. It's a huge forehand more like Nadal's huge forehand. There's a lot of revolutions, so he does get a good jump off of the clay court. So that's how the clay amplifies his forehand strength. It also minimizes his backhand weakness. How so? It's a different reason than the grass. It's because the court slows down the ball enough that Berrettini gets to hit extra forehands. So if you hit less backhands, if you don't have to hit as many backhands, that's a form of weakness minimization. You don't have to hit as many. And then obviously he can cheat even more to his left because it's easy even for him to recover to the deuce side because you have extra time because the ball's not moving through the court as quickly. So you're going to hit, any player is going to hit more forehands on clay. Any player who looks to run around is going to hit more forehands on clay and on a quicker surface like a fast hard court, much more backhands, less forehands. That is why Berrettini has won so much on clay and so much on grass and hard court. It just doesn't do either, right? It doesn't really reward his slice. It doesn't slow down enough for him to get more forehands. It doesn't work in the way that grass and clay work for him. Moving on to Houston, Ben Shelton wins his first career title on clay, second career title overall, beats Francis Tiafoe in that final. He's going to become American number one, first of all, after Monte Carlo. It's because Fritz lost today in Monte Carlo. That is a sure thing. So that's a big accomplishment to Ben. I had a feeling it was going to happen at some point. I have said for a long time that Shelton and Korda but mostly Shelton, have actually a higher ceiling than Fritz, Tommy Paul, and Tiafo. Now, ceilings aren't always reached, so it's not making any sort of, you know, sure thing claim. And, you know, Cord obviously in particular has a lot of work to do, but Ben is consistently, I see him improving. I'm going to get to that in a moment. I'm going to talk about all the things that I've seen him start to do better and better. But as far as the question of, is this a guy who's going to be doing things on clay, which I think is a really interesting question with Ben, you can look back at guys who have won Houston. And I know I said that Marrakesh is a top five 250 to win. Houston is up there too. Houston is definitely up there because a lot of the more pure clay court players after Miami leave the United States. And, you know, you do have a lot of Americans playing Houston who aren't necessarily clay courters. So winning Houston in itself isn't much of a tell. But Blair Henley on the ESPN Plus broadcast, Houston does something kind of that's a little bit unique from other tournaments. And in the U.S., it's on ESPN Plus. I think it's the only ATP event on ESPN Plus. Blair Henley said that Ben and Brian Shelton have been looking a lot recently at Nadal. They feel like the way Rafa played aggressive tennis with his forehand, you know, controlled play with his forehand, is something that can be emulated. And I was thinking about it. Rafa Nadal, this generational all-time great player. Where are the copycats, right? Obviously, there's a leftiness to it. There are less lefties. That means there are less likely, you know, there are less options. There are less people that even have the chance to try to do anything like Nadal, something like Nadal did. But where are the big forehand lefties, right? That's basically what I'm asking. And I was just kind of looking down the list, and I went to Tennis Abstract, and I'm like, let's look at the lefties. Ben Shelton is the only heavyweight forehand there is among lefties. Like, there's nobody else here with a heavyweight forehand. Now, there are some good forehands. I like Jack Draper's forehand. I like Alejandro Tabilo's forehand. I like Facundo Diaz Acosta's forehand. But none of them are heavyweight. And if you go down the list of Hugo Humbert, Ben Shelton, Adrian Mannarino, Cameron Norrie, Jack Draper, Tabilo, Dominic Kupfer, who's got a better backhand than forehand, Facundo Diaz Acosta, Yoshihito Nishioka, Hugo Gaston, Maximilian Martyr, Quarantine Mute, Albert Ramos Vinolas. Now I'm outside the top 100 already. You have Jerry Shang, who, again, I would kind of put in like the Diaz Acosta Tabilo category. Stricker hits a big forehand as well, but, you know, he's 117 in the world right now. It's not obvious, like, who takes that torch and is like, I'm going to be a lefty with a massive forehand. Here is why that's an advantage. Like, if you just think about the patterns of play that you can unlock if you're a lefty with a great forehand, there's two things. One, if you hit really good heavy cross-court forehands against righties, it's very hard for the right-hander to break up the pattern and get the rally back to your backhand. Because you have to redirect with the backhand down the line. And for most right-handers with the weaker backhand, it's going to be really hard to execute that backhand down the line if you're putting them under pressure. If you're hitting a good enough ball that makes them uncomfortable and has quality. So you keep getting forehands again and again and again, and then ultimately you're going to get a chance to attack with that forehand weapon if you keep getting forehands. When you go inside in with your forehand, I feel that's another big advantage. If you're a righty and you go inside in with your forehand, it better be good. Assuming, obviously, that you're playing another righty, which most of the time you are. If you go inside in with your forehand, righty to righty, you're giving your opponent a running forehand with the cross-court forehand open. Lowest part of the net, most court to hit into, the safest shot in the book, your cross-court forehand, and you're leaving court open into that shot. So if you're a righty and you hit a forehand inside in, you have to do damage. You have to disrupt your opponent's contact point or disrupt their balance, or you're in trouble. If you're a lefty, you have way more cushion. You have way more cushion hitting your forehand inside in because you're at least giving the right-hander a running backhand. They're not going to be able to get as much on the ball if they try to counter you to the cross court. So, you know, the righties have a little bit of that on the inside out where they get to go inside out at the backhand. Lefties, unfortunately, have to go inside out to the forehand. But why I think it's a good thing to be a lefty is the inside in, because it's a down the line, it's a more aggressive pattern. So if you're going to get that advantage off of the inside out or the inside in, the advantage of hitting to a backhand, I think it's better to get that advantage from your aggressive inside in. So I think lefties have, you know, are in a good spot there if they have a great forehand that can take advantage of all that. Shelton has that. Who has it except Ben? I don't really see it, which is crazy. Now, Shelton, I've said this for a while. I said it when he made that initial run at the Australian Open early at the beginning of last year. I even said it when he looked like a more polished player, had a better run against better players, and looked better at the U.S. Open. But I've always been 100% in on the Ben Shelton potential. Like, I am a huge advocate of his potential and what he has the ability to be. I've also been a pump the brakes guy about Shelton in the short term. I just feel like a lot of stuff isn't quite there, and I've always kind of beaten the drum of, hey, this is going to take a while because there's a lot of stuff here that's pretty underdeveloped, and he's got to work on all this stuff. For as good as it looks sometimes, other times it looks really bad. But the question, of course, always becomes, is this a guy who improves quickly? Is this a guy who improves at all? Rate of improvement is the number one thing you look for in a young player if you want to figure out how good they're going to be. So let me just quickly take stock of that. Ben is changing a lot.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
He's changing a ton. It's almost at Jannik Sinner levels of adjustments and, you know, constant development. I think, and what Shelton and Sinner have in common is they got off to a late start in the sport. And they're exceptional talents, right? But they weren't really at 10 years old being bred to be professional tennis players like some of these other guys. So, and maybe that is an explanation for why it at times it's looked like there's more to work on or things are more raw. But anyway, let's start with the forehand because we just talked about the Shelton forehand. The take back is way shorter. The racket face is oriented differently in terms of the take back. It used to kind of face the back fence, and now it kind of faces the side fence. You know, it went from here, if you're watching on video, to here. So that's a change. It's shorter. Everything's shorter. And the finish is way higher. Ben used to finish. First of all, sometimes he used to not finish, which was kind of a problem. And then sometimes he'd finish like literally on his other hip, on his opposite hip. He has brought that finish up way higher. To the point where a lot of the times it is kind of looking like Nadal. But, you know, sometimes it's here and sometimes it's here. You know, the players these days, they're not going to finish in the same spot every time. But it's a lot higher than it used to be. And that's giving him a steeper low to high, which is giving him more margin on his forehand. He is working on deep return position, which he didn't used to have. And I love that with his weight of shot and his athleticism. More and more players are now working on that and understanding they have to have it in the bag. But it was really effective against Tiafo here. One thing that we've documented really well is that Shelton has worked on his patience. It was a low bar. He was one of the most impatient players I've ever seen when he really first came up. So it was a low bar, but he's getting better and better in that area. He slices his backhand pretty well now when he's in trouble or when he's rushed. That's something that I think about Dominic Thiem. Now, Thiem had a one-hander, but he had to work on slicing his backhand in emergency situations or even just situations where the backhand was going to end up being low percentage because he wasn't great at hitting it when he was rushed on the run. The serve is more varied than it used to be. I still think it needs to get more consistent. It's a technical beauty, so it's hard to say why Shelton's serve can run so hot and cold, but this final against Tiafo was a good example because it did catch a cold patch there. End of the second set, start of the third set, and then you look at his last, three service games in the third set, and he served the lights out. And that tends to happen with Ben. Mentally, this is not an improvement. This is something he's always had. So I'm done on the improvement bit, but I do want to mention this. This was another big match where Shelton looked unshackled and excited to compete. There's no stress. There's no negativity. It's amazing how good he is mentally. It's his best asset, literally. I don't think it's his serve. I think it's that. Ultimately, if he's a guy who wins majors, at some point, maybe his game is going to become such a formidable package that it would be inevitable that he would win one. But trust me, he's the kind of guy who could win a major before he's even ready to win a major because he's so good mentally. Like he could be a Stan Wawrinka type player mentally, where he actually overachieves based on his skill set because of the mental. Tiafo, I know I'm not, delving into this match deep and talking about the X's and O's, and I won't get too much into Francis, but while we're on the mental topic, look, I could stand some more intensity from him after going down a break in the third. Now, at the U.S. Open when they played, Shelton sucked every bit of energy onto his side of the net, and Tiafo came out with a very, very flat performance where he seemed just a little bit mopey and a little bit shocked and just low energy the whole time. I mean, it was really a very mental match that Shelton got the better of. He was better at the start in this one. He was better for a lot of it. But again, you go down and break in the third set. How do you react? I didn't love the reaction there. I thought things were toned down from an intensity standpoint. And that's just, it's not the time to do it. It's not ideal. There was a point also in his service game where he ended up getting broken at 15:30 where Tiafo hit kind of a bad pass, or maybe it wasn't a bad pass, but it was such a good approach shot that Foe couldn't get much on the pass. Regardless, Shelton ended up with a pretty easy forehand volley on top of the net, and Tiafo kind of stopped trying. Like he did not really prepare for the next ball, and Shelton hit a horrible volley. Shelton hit such a horrible volley that what should have been an easy put away turned into a chance for Tiafo to hit another passing shot. But because Foe gave up on the point, he was a little bit slow getting back out to his left to hit the attempt at the backhand pass, and he couldn't really hit a good pass. And that's just an example of, let's just dial up the intensity a little bit to the point where you're not giving up on that point so soon. So that's all I got on Foe. He did do some good things. Forehand got a little bit inconsistent on him in the third set, which was a key factor. But ultimately, I think Ben played a great third set. What Tiafo started to do really well was hit hard into Shelton's forehand, and particularly by hitting damaging cross-court backhands. So that's what really worked for Tiafoe in the second set was to rush Shelton's forehand so that Ben wasn't dictating with that side anymore. And then obviously when he went to the backhand of Ben, it was more effective because he had set it up better. All right. Unfortunately, I don't have much to say about Hurkacz. I do hope that Esteril stays on the calendar. I also wish the camera angle was better, but that's my only complaint. It is one of the most beautiful stops on tour. I would love to go. I feel like all of tennis Twitter was there. Like a lot of people I follow, like, you know, obviously Jose Morgado and Damien Kust and Roberto Gaspar. I forget the third part of his name. Apologies. But yeah, I felt, oh, and Tennis Talker, right? John Silk, who's also a member of Tennis YouTube. So yeah, it was crazy how many people were there. But anyway, I love the event. The crowds are great. The fields are usually pretty solid too. I just wish the camera angle, the main angle for TV was better because it's way too high and too close to the court. You can't see the height of the ball. You can't see the speed of the athletes as well. And it just makes it look like, I don't even want to say it makes it look like ping pong, because when ping pong has a low angle, you can actually see the spin and the height on the ball really well. But it looks like, it looks like you're watching ping pong from an overhead cam, which is not ideal. I will say, I think Hubie is going to have a competent clay season. He's moving pretty well. I was actually pretty impressed with his movement. His forehand is in better shape than it was this time last year. And on clay, that's so essential because the serve isn't going to get the job done as often. The net rushing is not going to be as available. So you got to hit forehands. You got to hit forehands from the middle of the court. That's how you're going to attack. And the fact that it's been better since the end of grass court season last year, or maybe Wimbledon last year, that's huge for his clay prospects. Plus, sometimes the serve is so good, it doesn't matter that he's on clay. It just doesn't matter. So I think Hubie is going to have a decent, solid, respectable clay season. I'm not going to pick him to, you know, contend for the big titles, but I don't think there's going to be as much first and second round defeats as there have been at times in years past. And with that, let's get to the Monte Carlo preview. First clay Masters 1000 of the year. The most beautiful tournament of the year. And probably the slowest, you know, I think even if it measures up equal with Roland Garros, if you saw the mailbag or listened to the mailbag last week, you know that in terms of serve dominance rating, Monte Carlo and Roland Garros are pretty much equal. I still think it's harder to play attacking tennis at Monte Carlo because not only is the surface very slow, but it's generally windy. And I think that that plays a pretty big factor. It makes it even harder for players to be clinical from attacking positions. That's my only, I guess, preamble. Nothing else. All right. But Novak Djokovic is in the draw, and he is the number one seed. So let us get right to our quarter by quarter preview with dark horse picks, upset alerts, and early popcorns. For the aforementioned Djokovic quarter, the top seeds are Novak, Andrei Rublev, Alex de Minaur, and Taylor Fritz. My dark horse here is Lorenzo Musetti. My upset alert is Alex de Minaur. And my early popcorn probably might have been Musetti versus Fritz, but since that match has already been played and won in straight sets 6-4, 6-4 by the Italian, my early popcorn will now be de Minaur versus Wawrinka in round number one. All right, for Musetti, he's just a different animal on when the courts slow down like this. Obviously, he makes a lot more returns in play. He's able to get the points to neutral. He's able to use his movement. And that one-handed backhand becomes a real weapon. When he's, you know, 7 feet behind the baseline and he has all day to kind of load up and rip that thing, it becomes a very dangerous backhand. I thought he hit his forehand well against Fritz. Again, you know, this is not normally things that I can say in the preview, given I normally do it before the tournament starts. And then also, you know, obviously Musetti's movement is a big asset. And he can be very hard to hit through in these kinds of conditions. So there's a lot to like about Musetti, who has won a couple of matches the last 2 years at Monte Carlo. He beat Pear and Felix before losing to Schwartzman in 2022. He beat Kecmanovic, Nardi, and Djokovic last year before getting killed by Sinner. 6-2, 6-2, that was. My upset alert, Alex de Minaur. The clay makes him slower around the court. He does not move as well on the clay. He has a lot of trouble putting his opponents into trouble or doing damage with the flat ground strokes. Now, because he's gotten stronger, I'm sure he's going to be a little bit better at this than he has been in past years. He's also less consistent playing on the rise. De Minaur, despite him being a speedster, he does like to stay pretty far up in the court, and he likes to play on the rise, and it's tougher on clay. He plays Stan first round. Now, Wawrinka has lost a step this year, but he did play some of his best tennis probably of the season last week in Marrakesh. He peaks in these first round matches against top players at events he likes. I don't know how many more years of this there's going to be. Certainly last year, he was a very dangerous first round opponent. You can look at what the stats are. I don't have it down, but he was awesome in first rounds. He had plenty of big wins in first rounds. I guess one that just springs to mind is he beat Holger Rune at Indian Wells. So this is a perfect chance for Stan to get a big win. And there are not many left, but this is a big chance for it. And I think it could happen. Popcorn match, de Minaur versus Wawrinka. I think I've said all that needs to be said there. So let's jump right to the quarterfinal prediction. By the way, in general, I'm going to do this preview faster than usual for a couple of reasons. I'm going to go Rublev defeats Musetti. Rublev defeats Musetti. Okay, let's talk about Djokovic, right? I have not been optimistic about Novak Djokovic's chances at this tournament for probably like 4 years in a row now, predicting this tournament, and he proves me right every time. Now, he has a great draw on paper, but I just think the writing is on the wall in terms of his fitness and form right now. It looks like what this clay court season is going to be, and it wouldn't be the first time, is a slow building process. And what you want to track with Novak here is that he gets better and better every week, which I expect him to do, up until kind of Rome, where maybe you could expect him to be at his best or at least close to his best. But I think it's going to take some time. You don't just flip a switch and turn it on. And right now, Djokovic, you know, from what we've seen this year and based on Indian Wells and even pulling out of Miami, I don't think it's going to be there right away at Monte Carlo, which is, by the way, one of the most physical clay court events there is, or one of the most physical events there is, which can make things hard on a Novak when his fitness and his cardio is less than 100%. So that's that. Musetti has played him really well before in the past, obviously beat him last year at Monte Carlo, has been up 2-0 against him at Roland Garros. The backhand of backhand stuff, he does really well against Novak on clay, backhand of backhand. As for Rublev, who I have beating Musetti, Andre probably had the most disappointing sunshine double within the top 10. I know people are going to look at the Dubai incident and they're going to say, okay, that's why he was recovering from that. But really, I think he faced two guys who kind of hit him off the court to some extent. And on that note, I don't think it's said enough that Rublev is not the best returner in the world, is not the best pace absorber in the world, particularly on his backhand side. And it really helps him when conditions slow down and he can get into more baseline rallies. I've talked about many times on Monday Match Analysis about how Rublev hasn't really done all that well against the biggest servers in the world. So I think just as a general rule of thumb, when the conditions slow down to the point where Rublev can get into more rallies, it helps him because he's really a titan in those neutral baseline rallies where he can work the point and use his forehand. And his Monte Carlo resume is actually amazing. He is 13-4 at Monte Carlo since 2018. But those four losses, they are to Thiem, eventual champion Fanini, Tsitsipas in 2021, and Sinner last year. Not last year. He won it last year. He's the defending champion. Sinner the year before. All right, so amazing resume at Monte Carlo. I'll take Rublev to move on. Honestly, I actually think Musetti's a bad matchup for him, but I trust Rublev so much more mentally that I'm still just going to put him through. I do want to say one thing, though, about Rublev. Alexei Popyrin, first match, that's rough. That's not easy. And I know when you see like a big serving Australian, you don't think they're going to be good on clay. But Popyrin actually benefits massively from the extra time and the extra forehands. And he actually really likes playing deep in the court from way behind the baseline. And he's rewarded for that on clay when the ball bounces up a little bit higher. Last year, he went 14-5 on the clay. His last clay tournament was a title in Umag. And, you know, he came through qualifying here. He came through qualifying in Rome. So if Rublev is going to be vulnerable, it's probably going to be in his first match against someone with the weapons to make him feel uncomfortable. I think Popyrin could really give Rublev a run for his money, even though I'm picking Rublev. Let's go to the let's go to the Carlos Alcaraz quarter. He is the number 3 seed. With him is Casper Ruud, Hubert Hurkacz, and Hugo Humbert. My dark horse here is Alejandro Tabilo. My upset alert is Hubert Hurkacz. And my early popcorn, sorry to double dip again, is Hurkacz versus Draper, round number 1. Let's go to Tabilo. Back to...
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Back dark horses for Tabilo. Think I picked him. Yeah, I did. I picked him in Miami. It was almost looking really smart because he was a couple points away from beating Dimitrov. But in this case, it's not that I was clamoring to pick Tabilo as dark horse. It's that he's literally the only unseeded automatic entrant whose game doesn't suffer a little bit on clay. You have Felix, you have Zhang Zhizhen, you have Marcos Giron, you have... Those are the automatic entrants, I guess. There's a lot of qualifiers and lucky losers in this section, which honestly, probably if I were going to go for a dark horse... I might go to one of the qualifiers like outside of Tabilo. I might go to like Federico Coria or Roberto Bautista Agut, even, who's looking a little bit better, or the lucky loser, Facundo Diaz Acosta. But yeah, I mean, look, I'll go with Tabilo here with a shout out to Luca Nardi, because if Nardi wasn't playing Alcaraz second round, I'd probably give him a look and make it him. He's going to have great crowd support. Italians always do. He's on a 7-match win streak, won the Naples Challenger, came through qualifying here. I do think he'll beat Felix. I just don't think he'll beat Alcaraz. And I think kind of for that reason, Tabilo has a better chance of making a run. Upset alert, Hurkacz. Yep, he just made his first, he just won his first clay title. That is very fast clay. So first of all, I think Hurkacz has a history of winning titles and then losing early the next week. I don't think the change in conditions will be particularly easy. His serve effectiveness is going to take a bigger hit here than it takes anywhere else on tour. And he has to play Jack Draper. So, you know, the question is really, can Jack Draper take advantage? They played at Monte Carlo last year. Hubie won 7-5 in the third. They're both better. They're both improved from last year. Draper's a little bit inexperienced on the clay. His tour results are somewhat encouraging. His challenger results are somewhat concerning. But he is a very consistent player from the back. He plays with a lot of spin. He defends well. As long as he doesn't struggle a ton with his movement, I think he could get a subpar Hubie coming off that Estoril title, who isn't used to the conditions and can jump on him and beat him. So Hurkacz, upset alert. All right, let's go to the quarterfinal prediction. It is Carlos Alcaraz defeats Casper Ruud. First of all, I thought it was funny. People were making a thing because Alcaraz in practice, his forearm has been taped. And it just reminded me, you guys remember when Alcaraz won his first career title in Umag in 2021, what his right arm looked like? It looked like a bionic piece of metal. Like, that's how much taping was on his right arm. So I'm not concerned about that. This quarter is pretty weak. This is a really good draw for Alcaraz, especially in the condensed format when you honestly rarely say that. You just look at a lot of draws and they almost always look hard. But I think for Alcaraz here to, you know, to get Hurkacz, to get Humbert, to get a Casper Ruud, a guy who he's dominated, to not have a lot of unseeded players who actually like to play on clay even, it's a very nice draw, in my opinion, for Carlitos. Again, like, you know, maybe Nardi can be interesting, but I'm not sure. Alcaraz is back in a very positive headspace again. He's being a lot more sensible with the forehand. You know, he's only really played Monte Carlo once, and he got picked off by Korda early on a windy day when Seb played great. He just needs to be mindful, I think, Alcaraz, of not playing too aggressively, because Monte Carlo just isn't really going to reward you for playing that style. And I think as long as he does that, he's going to be in a really good spot. The Dimitrov match, the last loss that Alcaraz took, it didn't concern me whatsoever. As for Casper Ruud, he's night and day from where he was last year. He's just a way, way better player. He's playing off of his forehand much better. You know, that's the main difference. And he's won a ton of matches this year. But Alcaraz generally eats his backhand for breakfast, and I haven't really seen evidence that that is going to change. Plus, Ruud can overplay in big spots on the forehand when he's trying to blast forehands past the fastest guy in tennis. So while I'm pretty confident Ruud makes the quarterfinal, I'm pretty not confident that he gives Alcaraz a run for his money if this match ends up happening. Let's go to Daniil Medvedev's quarter. Top seeds are Alexander Zverev, Stefanos Tsitsipas, and Karen Khachanov. My dark horse here is Francisco Cerundolo. My upset alert is Karen Khachanov. My early popcorn is Medvedev versus Monfils question mark round number two. All right, let's start with Cerundolo. He is out of the rut that he was in at the start of the season, at least mentally. The slower, the better for him, so he can make a lot of returns in play, and then he can go to work with his forehand off the ground. He's in a section with Medvedev and Khachanov, which is way better than being in the other section in this quarter with Zverev and Tsitsipas, so the draw opportunity is there. I know he lost first round in Houston. I actually think that's a good thing. I hate it when players go deep in Houston. I think it dooms you for Monte Carlo. The conditions adjustment, but mainly the jet lag. The jet lag is terrible. And I just never see a player do well in Houston, go to Monte Carlo and do well. I just never see it. I don't know. Maybe it's because of the fields in Houston, but I honestly think it's just a really tough turnaround. Upset alert, Karen Khachanov. His career record best of three clay at tour level is only 38-37. So this has been a rough format for the big man. Nori first round, I think Cam might be able to drag him into a battle. Nori is really good in slow clay when he's playing good ball, I'll say. And then it would be Cerundolo next, who I think, if, you know, Khachanov doesn't hit with a lot of variety and they end up getting into these very kind of vanilla exchanges from the back, I just think Cerundolo's forehand is going to break it open. I just think it's going to break it open. So I like Cerundolo in that. Popcorn match, Medvedev versus Monfils. Let me give some justification for that. Gail has beaten Medvedev twice in a row and leads the head-to-head 2-1. So, and then it's Medvedev on clay. It's Gail. I think there's a lot to like there. But Monfils would need to win his first-round match against Jordan Thompson. Jordan Thompson does not like clay courts, so I do think Gail will win that. Let's go to the quarterfinal. I have Francisco Cerundolo defeating Alexander Zverev. Yeah. Gonna go with a bit of a wild card here. Zverev hasn't been great at Monte Carlo in his career. I don't know if it's he struggles with the initial adjustment of changing surfaces, or if it's his high ball toss and the wind messes with it and he doesn't serve as well. I also look at the way he's winning this year, and I feel like Zverev's serving has actually gone up a level. He's making more first serves. He is hitting his second serve the best he's ever hit it. But in these conditions, they play a lot from neutral. And Cirundolo has the best ground stroke on court by a lot. I compare Khachanov and Zverev all the time. I feel like Zverev from the baseline is the same as Karen, just with a better serve. I think that it's good for Cirundolo that I just think that's a good style of player for Cirundolo to play on a slow clay court, because I think his forehand is the difference maker there. It's the same thing. So going with Francisco to make the semis. Lastly, we have the two seed Jannik Sinner. He's got Holger Rune, Grigor Dimitrov, and Alexander Bublik. My dark horse here is Matteo Berrettini. I don't have an upset alert, and my early popcorn is Borna Coric versus Jan Lennard Struff in the second round. Unlike the last quarter, or Alcaraz's quarter, I should say, this is a quarter where I feel like every unseeded player is interesting. You have Davidovich Fokina, you have Sebastian Korda, you have Jan Lennard Struff, you have Borna Coric, you have Matteo Berrettini, you have Matteo Arnaldi. I feel like it's options galore when it comes to dark horse. So I had to think, and I'm just like, I'm asking myself a very simple question. Who would I be least surprised to see in the semifinal? And the answer to that is Berrettini. I won't get any deeper. I've already kind of said my piece about Berrettini at the start of the show. Second place is probably Coric, because I do think if you're super physical and you keep the ball in the court, it can work here. It gives you a chance. And, you know, if he caught Sinner on an off day, I do think that Coric could take advantage of that. But ultimately, upset alert, I couldn't give it to anybody. Bublik was obviously a seed in this quarter. He got destroyed by Coric today. You know, this man on clay, sometimes he just doesn't turn up and his serve doesn't work as well and it's a disaster. It was one of those. So that's that. But I don't see any of the other three guys losing early. Popcorn, Struff versus Coric. I think that's a really fun contrast of styles. And it's two guys who actually made Clay Masters 1000 semifinals last year. Very different clay, Madrid, but still. It made me think of Madrid to see them matched up. Anyway, I think that's a really interesting matchup. Quarterfinal prediction. Let's do it. I got Jannik Sinner defeating Holger Rune. I thought about looking at Sinner and Dimitrov here. I thought about it. Miami final rematch. But look, it's hard to go deep in Miami, go deep at Monte Carlo. It's really not easy to do it. You know, Rude and Alcaraz, for example, both lost really early in 2022. Hurkacz lost second round at Monte Carlo in 2021 after winning Miami. Sinner, if you look at it, has been okay at transitioning. He hasn't had that big explosive run at Monte Carlo. Almost happened last year. He played an epic in the semifinal with Rune. But that's been something that's impressed me about Jannik, is actually how well he's transitioned from Miami, which has historically been his best event, to Monte Carlo, where he's also had decent results. Now, he lives in Monte Carlo. He trains at that club all the time. That might have something to do with it. So, you know, I think Sinner, if he did it last year, if he went final weekend at Indian Wells, final weekend at Miami, final weekend at Monte Carlo, all three. If he did it last year, then who am I to say he can't do it this year when he's just a better player and more physical? As for Rune, it's kind of, look, I don't know. It's tough. The question is he going to flip a switch and play like he did last year on clay, even if overall he's not showing a lot of signs that he's about to be an elite player over the course of the next 2 months? If you look at just his record against top 20 players as of late and where he's at in the race, like what is he in the race right now? This is the race. 17th. He's 17th in the race heading into clay. So doesn't inspire confidence, but we know what happened last year. He came to Monte Carlo. He played more patient, high, heavy forehands. Defense was absurd. You know, he was able to counterattack with his backhand and finish with craftiness, drop shots coming forward at times. Like, just a very interesting, varied, dynamic game with amazing defense. So can he just flip a switch and do that, potentially? And, you know, Dimitrov, compared to Sinner, he has been more serve forehand reliant, which makes me more inclined to feel like him, after going deep in Miami, hitting the clay right away, it's not going to be as easy for him to make that transition. All right. Final weekend prediction in 3, 2, 1. Alcaraz defeats Rublev in 3 sets. Sinner defeats Cirindolo in 2 sets. Alcaraz defeats Sinner in 3 sets. I didn't know if I wanted to go chalk here because of the whole Miami factor, and I do think it's hard to go Miami to Monte Carlo, and obviously Alcaraz and Sinner both kind of would be doing that here. I also considered picking Sinner again. You know, I think it's hard to play attacking tennis in Monte Carlo. You have to be patient. You have to be consistent. You have to defend. You have to grind a little. And I'm thinking, okay, Sinner is usually a little bit more willing to do that. But I'm falling back ultimately on the idea that Alcaraz, in a good headspace when his forehand is firing, is going to be the best player in the world in very slow conditions. That is like my principle. So I'm just sticking with that principle, and I'm going with Alcaraz for that reason. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.